Did Charles Darwin himself think evolution marched inevitably toward greater complexity and, ultimately, to human beings? Historian and philosopher of science Robert Richards says yes. As he told Steve Paulson, this is a highly unorthodox view among Darwin scholars.
Darwin came to the view that progress, the development of more complex creatures, would be the inevitable outcome. And it was progress not simply in, as it were, biological complexity, the complexity of physiology and anatomy, but he also foresaw, at least the early Darwin did, a moral progress, that the universe was oriented toward the production of human beings. That's at least clear from his early notebooks.
Well, I have to say that this is not at all the conventional view among Darwinian scholars. I mean, most people I've talked to say that Darwin was the one who killed all sense of teleology and moral purpose.
Right.
I mean, sort of the great revolutionary idea of Darwin was that he divorced evolution from any sense of meaning or purpose.
I think that's the usual interpretation. You're absolutely right. But from my perspective, what has happened is there has been a rereading or a reading of contemporary neo-Darwinism back into Darwin's accomplishment. And needless to say, Darwin was not a neo-Darwinian. I certainly accept the orthodox view of evolutionary biologists today. But I don't think that was exactly Darwin's view.
It sounds like you're saying that this is all very interesting historically, but Darwin got it wrong given what we now know about how evolution works.
Well, there's a certain sense in which any scientist that worked 2 years ago got it wrong, that his science develops, it progresses, but it's built upon earlier accomplishments. And there is certainly no doubt that what Darwin accomplished in The Origin of Species formed the foundation for the development of modern biology. But I think one of the other aspects of reexamining what Darwin accomplished is to appreciate Darwin's moral theory. And from his perspective, human beings are intrinsically moral creatures. Now, there has been, I would say, in the last, 50, 60 years, a presumption that natural selection has produced creatures that, namely us, that are selfish. That wasn't Darwin's view.
Now, in the larger debate about evolution and religion, it would seem there is a great deal at stake about this whole question of purpose. I mean, it's just hard for a lot of religious believers to stomach the idea that evolution is strictly a product of random genetic mutations, that there is no underlying purpose, and human beings are just an evolutionary accident. Would you say this is an important question in terms of how we think about evolution?
Well, I think it certainly is. I mean, to follow out Darwin's trajectory just a little bit, The Origin of Species, published in 1859, that's the first edition. It goes through six editions, and Darwin is always changing it and responding to his critics. But it's during this period that there's a certain sense in which Darwin became a neo-Darwinian, so that by the mid-1860s, he had lost belief in a personal God. The term that he thought that best suited him was that formulated by his friend Thomas Henry Huxley, namely agnosticism. He was an agnostic. But when pressed, is this all a matter of chance? He said, well, he found it very difficult to believe that it was all a matter of chance. But then he said, but it's all very complex and let each person believe what he will. And I guess I don't think the scientific evidence is going to allow us to move one way or the other on that question.
University of Chicago historian of science Robert Richards talking with Steve Paulson.
Darwin pondered variations, the reasons for mutation. He wasn't feeling good, but he had money and time. He published The Origin of Species by natural selection. A lot of people didn't want to be descended from apes.
Come on. Ruth Padell is not only an acclaimed British poet, she is a direct descendant of Charles Darwin, and she grew up hearing stories about her famous ancestor. Now Padell's written a book called Darwin, A Life in Poems. Here's an excerpt from a poem called On Not Thinking About Variation in Tortoiseshell, which takes us back to the time when Darwin puzzled over the strange creatures he saw in the Galapagos Islands.
Look, giant tortoises. Travelling eagerly, their necks outstretched, to springs. I try riding on their backs, but found it hard to balance. The colony's vice-governor told us he knew which island any shell came from because they differ. I did not for some time pay this enough attention. I never dreamed that islands 60 miles apart, made of the same stone, of nearly equal height in the same climate, could have different tenants. Fast forward 20 years, and you see him write of this scatterburst of rock in open sea. We seem brought near that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on the earth.
This is a great moment in Darwin's life, although even in your telling, I'm not sure he knew it at the time.
It was a very interesting moment. He'd been there for nearly 5 years on that boat going around South America. I mean, when he first got into a hammock in Plymouth around Christmas time in 1831, he had the Greek Testament with him in Greek. He had Milton's Paradise Lost. He had Lyell's Geology. And he believed in the Bible story and Genesis as everybody did. He was going to be a parson. And 5 years later, this is the Galapagos, it says September 1835, 4.5 years later, he had revised his opinions about a lot of these things, principally about the geology, because he realized that all these, the dead sea animals that he was seeing, that is the fossils, meant that the earth must be much, much older than any Bible story could convey. But it was when he was sailing away from the Galapagos, he sat down in his journal, he wrote a long, long note on the ornithology in which he really was challenging what a species was and whether new ones could come to be. And that was the radical idea. Everybody believed that species could not change.
Listening to you talk about it, I'm realizing, I think, why you decided to render his life in poems. You see it as full of life, as full of art as it is of science. But this is unusual, this decision to write a biography of Darwin in poems. And when did that idea come to you?
Well, I mean, a long time ago, I was a classics major in college, and then I did a PhD. And while I was doing that, I looked after my grandmother, who was his granddaughter, Nora Barlow. Her name was Nora Barlow. She was nearly 100. She'd lost her short-term memory, but my goodness, she could do the Times crossword, okay, faster than anybody. And she'd also had her long-term memory was fine. And she was the first person to work on Darwin's papers at all. In 1933, she'd edited the journal of the Voyage of the Beagle and his notebooks. She was really the first person to look at those notebooks and put them together and think about them. And in those amazing conversations, as I was sort of cooking her scrambled eggs and things, she told me that when Charles was evolving his ideas, it was very difficult for his wife, Emma, because she was a devout Christian and he knew it and they were very close and it was a very honest and transparent relationship. And she also said, do not ever change what you're thinking for fear of hurting me. But I thought, oh, I would love to write something about that.
His voyage on the Beagle, I gather, was really where it began. And you bring it to life in several of the poems. And there's one of them I wonder if you'd read, in fact, The Cat O' Nine Tales.
Oh, my goodness, yes, sure. When he was in Cambridge, he wasn't a scientist. He was studying divinity. He was going to be a parson. It was the botany professor who suggested to him that he might go on this Admiralty expedition to map the coast of South America. But his father said, no, you can't go. These ships are dreadful places, terrible discipline, and you catch disease. But his father came round. Of course, as soon as the ship set sail, first of all, he was very seasick. And secondly, he realized his father was quite right, that there was this dreadful discipline. They were delayed over Christmas because the crew went ashore and all got drunk. And this is the first thing that he experienced on board. Cat O' Nine Tails. Shrieks above, on deck. That's one sailor lashed by the cat 25 times for drunkenness. Three strands of rope unraveled into three. A trinity of trinities sets sinners on the path to righteousness. Drum rolls. All hands to witness punishment. In the Bay of Biscay, the naturalist lies retching on the floor, trying not to picture barbed knots biting across on every spine and shoulder blade, a glary scarlet scribble on open flesh. Again, again, again. 31 lashes for neglect of duty. Disobeying orders? 34. 44, that's drunkenness with insolence. The captain says he must establish order from the start.
You know, I wonder while you're there if you would read the very next one, Plankton, which is a different view of that same voyage. A little bit more of the joy he found in it, I think.
Absolutely. And this is really the first time he starts to be a proper naturalist. This is January 1832, and the Beagle is heading south through the North Atlantic towards the Cape Verde Islands. Plankton. The deck is dazzle, fish stink, gauze-covered buckets, gelatinous ingots, rainbows of wet flinching amethyst and flubbed iridescent cream. All this means he's better and working on a haul of lumpen light. Polyps, plankton, jellyfish, sea butterflies, the pteropods. So low in the scale of nature, so exquisite in their forms, you wonder at so much beauty, created, apparently, for such little purpose.
It's wonderful. Of course, one of the great mysteries is why Darwin waited several decades before he wrote The Origin of Species. Apparently he wanted to get the science right before he published his great book. But he was also worried about the reaction of his wife, Emma, who, as you said, was a devout Christian. You have a poem about salvation, which deals with her fears. Could you read this?
I'd love to. I'm very glad you picked that one out, because her mind, her voice, that was one of the joys for me of doing this work, was learning her voice and her thought. But it was very painful to her. This is when she's pregnant, and they're living together, but she has one big last try to get him to see things as she does. She writes him a note about salvation. "When I talk to you face to face, I cannot say exactly what I wish. Her back aches all the time. His friend's wife has died in childbirth. You say you are uncertain about Christian revelation, but your opinion is still not formed. He's told her his discoveries. She'd love him to be right in everything. She's very afraid he's not. Faith is beyond our comprehension, not provable in the scientific way you like. I believe you sincerely wish to learn the truth, but there are dangers in giving up revelation and Christ's offer of eternal life. My fear is for the afterlife. I cannot say how happy you make me in this one, nor how dearly I love you. I thank you for all the affection, which makes my happiness more and more each day. But everything that concerns you concerns me. I should be most unhappy if I thought we would not belong to each other for eternity."
It's unimaginable that she really thought they wouldn't.
Well, that was the most common thing. May I read the next little one too?
Oh, please.
Because this one is so important. That letter that I've used in that poem was found among his things after his death for her to find with his little note on it. He died in 1881, and that letter was written in 1839. So it was a tatty old letter which he'd written on the edge of. He leaves a message on the edge. He kept her note all his life. He must have said something then, but he wrote to her too, on the outer fold. No one knows when. He was maybe quite old. He wasn't blind to where his thought led, what she thought she'd lose. "When I am dead, no, I have kissed and cried over this many times."
Ruth Padell is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Her book is called Darwin, A Life in Poems.
Chromosome divides, multiply and thrive, and the strong
Later this hour, the strange questions paleoanthropologists ask themselves.
What are my favorite skulls? You go to something like OH5, a real classic recognizable skull. If you imagine the scene at the end of Close Encounters, where the aliens kind of come out of the spaceship, and you see they're sort of like us. You know, they're toddling around, and they're bipeds. They're on two legs, and they've got arms, and they're sort of funny looking. That's what these guys were like, these real early hominids. The difference between these and the aliens is that these guys were probably furry, and they had very small brains. But the world was full of them until 1.2, 1.3 million years ago, and they're gone.
As the Virginia Slims ad used to say, you've come a long way, baby. But human evolution isn't done yet. In fact, it's speeding up. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, What Does Evolution Want? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions. By Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science. And by the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.